According to his headstone, Joseph Noonan was born in Rathcormack, a village in Cork, Ireland, and died in Perth in 1885, aged 43. Nothing remarkable about that, you might think, but dig a bit deeper, if that's the phrase I'm after, and you discover he managed to fit several lives into one brief one. Not long after Noonan died, his passing was noted back home in an obituary in the Dublin Freeman's Journal. As you can guess from the name, this newspaper was staunchly Republican. And before hearing the obituary, you need to realise that Noonan was transported to Perth in 1867. He was a builder by trade, and in Australia since his release a dozen years ago, he became a prosperous and well-known citizen. One of the features in his imprisonment was his daring escape shortly after his first arrest. He was in a railway car, travelling at 40 miles an hour with two policemen, when he jumped clean through the window. He was an able man in his profession, and all who knew him respected him. R.I.P. Joseph Noonan was a member of the Fenian Brotherhood, opposed to British rule in Ireland, an active member of a gang helping other guerrillas escape from Killarney. He admitted to shooting a police officer to his comrades during the uprising of 1867. Facing possible execution if the British caught him, Noonan escaped to France, but was arrested when he returned some months later to London. You might wonder why he'd do that, but there are stranger twists to come. Constable Gunning and a sergeant marched him to Euston Station, and the three took seats in first class for the night express to Liverpool. From there, the plan was to catch the ferry back to Dublin for the processing. The train wound in a northwest direction towards Liverpool, and just past Rugby, Noonan asked if he could have the handcuffs off. Constable Gunning complied. Later, Gunning and others would describe Noonan as tall and powerful, but he must have been a gymnast because the moment the officer's attention was somewhere else, he pulled down the window and, in his words, hands on the sill with a cat-like spring, shot through the window. According to others, the train was doing 50 miles per hour. Landing like a cat as well, and with only a few scratches to worry about, Noonan could have got away, but he needed cash. So in Atherston, further along on the Liverpool line, he pawned his coat, bought a cap, and sent a wire to Ireland asking for more funds. It's as though Noonan wants to be caught, but the police want him to escape. He wasn't hard to find. Around 10 that night, two officers tracked him to a boarding house where he gave up without a fight. Technically, Noonan should have been tried in Killarney, but a riot broke out before he even left Dublin, so he was locked up at heavy security Nass Jail in Kildare before being taken to trial in Tralee, Kerry. At his trial, the story of the original shooting came out. Constable William Duggan was riding his horse from Killorgan to Caersavine in Kerry, carrying dispatches, when a bullet knocked him out of his saddle. He lay still for a while, then limped to a nearby cottage. The wrong one, he soon figured. While he was waiting for a drink of water, the occupants sent for the last man he'd want to meet, Colonel John Joseph O'Connor, JJ to his friends, leader of the Fenians and veteran of the US Civil War. O'Connor arrived with about 30 guerrillas behind him and asked Duggan what happened. Noonan stepped up and said he'd shot him. O'Connor then read through the dispatches, counted Duggan's money and told him to cheer up. He'd seen much worse during the American War. For shooting Duggan, Noonan was sentenced to 7 years in the Swan River Colony. It could have been worse. You could even call it a win-win. After 2 years, Noonan got his life back and the colony got St Patrick's in York, Padbury Stores in Guildford and a sizeable part of the Perth Town Hall, among other buildings, most of which have been demolished. What survives, however, shows that the architect, Richard Roach Jewell, also buried at East Perth, had discovered a man who could bring his drawings to reality. For a long time, well into the 20th century, Perth was a city of transients, of people who came to try their luck, on the goldfields, on the railways, in construction, and later in farming, or like Joseph Noonan, sent here against his will. They didn't think it was paradise or even a place to set down roots. Only later, they might discover that having disembarked at Fremantle, intending to stay a few months at most, that it was 20 years later, and they had a family to take care of. Incidentally, Joseph Noonan's escape was enough to get him an entire chapter in the hagiography of the 1867 uprising, Fenian Heroes and Martyrs, by John Savage. Back in Ireland, Noonan was considered a far more significant figure than John Boyle O'Reilly and the Catalpa escapees. Joseph Noonan's headstone is typical of those in East Perth. It's modest in its description. We learn who lies below, where and when he was born, when he died, and there's an expression of regret at his passing. There's no mention of his contribution to Perth's architecture or his dramatic exploits back home, just enough to start tracking his life story. Scattered through the grounds, however, are headstones that raise far more questions than they answer. I say they, but I really mean we, the people trying to get to the bottom of their mystery. A small, curved slab, easy to miss along the pig face and the pussy willows, bears the very minimal inscription RHC 1871, and underneath that CSC 1867. The headstone looks more recent than the 1870s. There isn't the extensive lichen or discolouring of the marble, and the engravings are cleaner than we'd expect on headstones over 150 years old. Reinterments and replacements of headstones are common in all historic cemeteries, but usually it's the families who've driven that. And if that was the case here, why hide the occupants' names? Also, when families arranged for a replace headstone, they are likely to either ask for a replica with no details changed or add more information, such as putting names to initials. So, if the family didn't replace the headstones, who did? You can fairly assume that the occupants are married, or family anyway, since they share a last initial. But who is the husband, or father? Who is the wife, or mother? And they died in different years, so somewhere there are records for them, and at some point, someone must have known the two people were connected. In other words, the occupants were most likely reinterred with a new headstone, but whoever was responsible only had their initials and their death dates to go on. You might say there are lots of people buried under those circumstances, but why then aren't there more headstones like this one in East Perth? It's one of those situations where every possibility considered has a compelling answer against it. The solution to this small mystery is logical and quite likely very ordinary, but we may never know what it is. And that brings me to the strange, sad story of Japanese woman Otoki Matemoto. In Japanese culture, the surname comes first, so it should read Matemoto Otoki. But her name on the headstone conforms to European conventions, so we will call her Otoki. We know this much about her from records at the State Library and the Royal Perth Hospital Museum. On November the 19th, 1895, she was admitted to Perth Hospital Infectious Diseases Unit with phthisis, or TB, and died on December the 12th. She was 28 years old, married to someone listed in the records as Mr. Matemoto. Her religion, as stated on the hospital records, was J, or Japanese, meaning Buddhist or Shinto. That she was married is reinforced by the curious addition of Mrs., in inverted commas, to the headstone. Let's begin with her illness. Phthisis is the medical term for TB, though it can also refer to Meniere's disease or black lung, similar to asbestosis. TB is highly infectious. Black lung isn't. The sufferers had to be working in mines where coal and silica were being inhaled. Otoki had TB. Today, it's the second most fatal infectious disease in the world behind COVID. But most sufferers live in the developing world and effectively remain invisible. For that reason, it can be hard to appreciate how terrified Australian society was of a TB epidemic in the late 19th century. One infected person sneezing in a busy street could pass the illness on to dozens of others, and a measure of the fear can be seen in the British Royal Commission on Tuberculosis report handed down in 1896. People didn't understand the disease, and there was widespread belief that it could be passed through cow's milk or beef. Scientists did detect the bacillus in milk, but declared it was not dangerous, which was a relief to farmers in Britain and here, because the alternative would have wiped out an industry both nations depended upon. If you remember the mad cow epidemic of the 1990s, the beef industry in Britain hasn't returned to levels before then, and experts are predicting a second outbreak. As someone infected with TB, Otoki would have been confined to the infectious diseases ward. That building still stands. It's the white weatherboard house beside the Victoria Square entrance to RPH. Today, sufferers can be put on a course of antibiotics. Back then, there was very little that could be done apart from isolating them. In her last 3 weeks of life, Otoki would have been haggard and shriveled, reminding us of TB's other name, consumption. She would have also been denied visitors. TB kills, but it isn't necessarily a death sentence. In a lot of annual reports from the hospitals, while its presence in the community is noted, the number of deaths can be low. Looking at the material history, the record books, the small ward, her headstone attached to the hospital, you hope that the staff felt a particular pity for Otoki, a woman still young and far removed from home, which brings us to the Japanese community in WA in the 19th century. There were never very many. Even when the gold rush trebled, then quadrupled the state's population, there was around 200 Japanese in 1896, and most of the community lived on the goldfields or in Broome, where they worked in the pearling industry. In March 1896, an article appeared in the Daily News describing the new suburb of Victoria Park. For various reasons, namely facts and evidence, the article itself is really unreliable, but it does have one statement there's no reason to doubt. It's the height of the gold rush, and the writer describes the canvas town of about 60 tents that has sprung up around the causeway. Then he mentions a run-down building nearby, inhabited by Japanese. He doesn't say how many, only that the Japanese are ubiquitous, which is interesting only because they're not. Anyway, we get a feeling for the mistrust, even the paranoia, that infects WA society at this time. We get it again in 1901, when a Japanese clerk at the Sydney consulate, Tsunaji Aiba, visited the state and reported on the Japanese communities in Broome, Kew, Kanowna and Kalgoorlie, but not apparently Perth, and said that every Japanese woman, official figures estimate around 50 in the state, was or had worked as a prostitute. In the 1970s, David Sissons wrote what is still the best analysis of Japanese women in WA at this time, Japanese Prostitutes in Australia, 1887 to 1916, and points out that the real suspicion of these women has nothing to do with sex or disease, but that they would take over the pearling industry. As the French say, the more things change, the more they stay the same. We've never overcome our fear of outsiders. But back to Otoki. Good historians are cautious, especially when the evidence is ambiguous. But I'm going to stick my neck out and say that the Mrs., in inverted commas, inscribed on her headstone, is a direct reference to that statistic. that by calling her Mrs., whoever paid for the headstone wanted it made clear that she was a woman deserving respect. Incidentally, prostitution wasn't an official job title in the 1890s. Japanese women often have that occupation recorded as laundry worker or domestic, which is why the statistic is easily hidden. But information on Japanese workers in Western Australia was fairly thorough on account of the 1874 Imported Labour Registry Act, a precursor to the White Australia policy. According to the Act, persons apparently natives of India, China, Africa, Australia, or of the islands in the Indian or Pacific Oceans, or of the Malayan archipelago, would register immediately on disembarking, and the list shall contain the following particulars of such persons: name as at place of birth, and name at time of furnishing list, sex, apparent age, ordinary place of residence, place of birth, place where shipped and date of shipment, calling or occupation, intended place of residence, name, residence, and description of employer, intended employment. Surprisingly, not if you've tried to find any information about her, Otoki avoided that process. Perhaps she came in under another name, but there's a lot of perhapses in her story, and one big one. Why was she buried in a Christian section? That would have taken serious negotiations with the authorities, but perhaps we'll never know. The Japanese were an exotic presence in WA, which is a good thing for historians because religious festivals were closely watched and reported on in detail. In September 1898, two Japanese residents of Kanauna, a man and a woman, were shot dead by a third who found them in bed together. The funeral of the murdered man was conducted by a Wesleyan minister, and the journalist was told by a Japanese bystander that nearly a quarter of the Japanese in WA were Christians. That isn't a statistic a lot of modern historians would agree with, but then modern historians will also tell you that there are large blank spaces in the story of the Japanese community in Western Australia. So we've come to the end. You can visit the East Perth cemeteries on Sundays, where there are hundreds more stories to discover. There are maps and apps that give you guided tours of the cemeteries. But I also recommend taking time to wander through without guidance and discovering stories by accident. Audio was recorded and mixed at Fremantle Recording Studios. Dr. Noel Nanup provided cultural advice. And the entire project was made possible with an Inspire residency through the National Trust of WA and funding from the Heritage Council.